On today's show, this year is the 40th anniversary of the publication of The House on Mango Street by Sandra Cisneros. To mark the occasion, there's a brand new edition from the Everyman's Library, and joining me to talk about the book, its history, and its legacy is Professor John Philip Santos, who wrote the introduction for this new edition. Professor Santos is a writer and a producer and professor of borderland studies at the University of San Antonio. But he's not only a scholar, but a friend of Sandra Cisneros and a fellow writer. Really enjoyed this conversation and a chance to read House on Mango Street again. Looking forward to it. Here we go. Professor Santos gets to talk to us today, who has been following House on Mango Street and Cisneros for, I guess, now the 40th anniversary of the occasion that we're here today. And you wrote this wonderful introduction to this new edition. And I guess what I'd like to start with is, you knew both House on Mango Street and Cisneros before they were House on Mango Street and Cisneros, as we know them now. Could you tell about those sort of antediluvian days were like? What was she like? What were you like? What was your encounter with the novel?
The days of distant yore.
Yeah.
Well, it's a really funny story how we met. We met by a strange serendipity that had befallen us at that point in our lives, which was that I had left graduate school. I returned to San Antonio and was looking for a gig here. And there was this opening for a directorship in the literature program at the new Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center in San Antonio, a new cultural arts center that was being created expressly to showcase Chicanx arts, Mexican-American literature, visual art, performance, dance, theater. And I'd learned I was a finalist. And late one Sunday night, one of the directors of this new institution called and said, the other finalist was coming into town. Might I please be able to go pick her up? So the other finalist was Sandra. And that's how we met. So we met literally on her first trip to San Antonio, and became fast friends in a way that I guess sometimes we're lucky as writers to meet another writer who's as passionate about their work and as curious about the world. And very quickly, our dialogue was about writing, about being Mexican-American, about the legacy of our family histories. A lot of things I'd already been thinking about, but really didn't have an interlocutor for. And especially one who was like Sandra, just having come through the Iowa Writers' Workshop, was really focused on the craft and focused on refining her practice as a writer who was committed to social change, a writer who had a conscience. And so that began this 40-year-long dialogue, an incredible journey together. That was the moment when she arrived in San Antonio. Mango Street had been completed and was about to be published by a small press in Houston named Arte Público, a press that's been really important in Chicanx letters, has published Gary Soto, and a host of folks had their first publication there. I think Jimmy Santiago Baca as well. And so they couldn't promote it much. The magic of Mango Street, I think, is the way in which, I think in large part, certainly in those, it moved by word of mouth.
Yeah.
So people, in their first contact with this voice, I think passed it on. And eventually it would be republished, I think, by, was it Random
Vintage,
House?
I believe. I think it was Vintage. Which Vintage. Imprint of Random House.
Yeah. And exactly the history now. And then everything that ensued. So we know much of the rest of the story. But I think the thing that stands out for me about meeting Sandra at that time was just the passion she had for writing. I thought I was pretty obsessed with writing as a craft and literature as an obsession. But Sandra had a sort of a burning scrutiny and an insistence on detail and on bringing the totality of voices that she wanted to express into this new kind of vernacular. And that was a big part of rereading Mango Street for me recently.
Yeah, you mentioned, I want to get your recent encounter with it again. When you talk about her intensity and interest and ambition for her own writing, can you talk about how that shows up in Mango Street? I guess a couple of things that you mentioned, my own recent rereading too. For those of people who don't know,
My old edition that I read first in college is 103 pages. And it's not even that when you think about vignettes, they're broken up. There's a page or two. So there's a lot of half and quarter pages so left over. And yet it is so, it has this gem-like quality, both in terms of size, but in terms of sort of hardness and clarity. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Sandra has written about the way Mango Street came to be, the kinds of routines and riffs and improvisations that she brought to the practice. She'd come through the Iowa program really focused on being a poet. So she was and had a manuscript of poetry as well, ready for publication the time we met. So some of that kind of poetic compression, I think, is part of the formula behind what emerged as Mango Street. And when you say that they are gem-like, they are lapidary. They're beautifully cut, and there's a lot of economy of language. I veer more towards the Baroque or the Rococo or the in Mexico we call it the churrigueresco, the Mexican super Baroque. So Sandra has always been a great reader for me in terms of finding this crisp and sharp vernacular and getting to kind of the nub of the detail of what you're going for. She writes about it in terms of specifically ways that those short pieces work on their own terms. I mean, they have that kind of quality of being part of this evolving narrative, but each one, you can read it out of order. There's no specific timeline that dictates the structure of that book. They have some, as she says, kind of end like a mariachi song with a great sort of trumpet blast at the end or a grito. Some have a little bit more of a pianissimo effect or move off into a mystery. So she was, I think, in that period, there was, we're talking here like, mid, there was a lot of prose poetry in the air. There were a lot of writers that we were interested in, Eastern European writers, could write in these kind of very compact prose poem forms, Vasco Popa and Czesław Miłosz. So there are all kinds of influences rolling through the book. Even though it's not expressly named as Chicago, I've always heard a lot of Chicago, Midwestern twang in there, in terms of some of the voices and Sandra's long affinity for the work of Studs Terkel, and specifically the texture of oral histories of what in the Spanish literary tradition we call the testimonio. That's present. So this is happening in the 80s at this moment in American letters, which is just beginning to take notice of the fact that there's already been more or less two generations of Mexican American writers. And the kind of work that they'd been doing was of a very different nature. Sandra's work, among others like Cherie Moraga, Gloria Anzaldúa, Ana Castillo, their work represented a departure from that Mexican American literary milieu that had kind of characterized the period of the Chicano civil rights movement. And Sandra's work, specifically Sandra's work, has this kind of interior move, kind of into the inner life, a much more complex capture of the inner life of a Mexican American young woman in that time.
And it's Esperanza Cordero is the young woman. And as you write in the introduction, though, she becomes, or you're reading as she becomes sort of a medium for a web of related, but could be disparate kinds of relationships as well. The form follows the function a little bit there, I suppose, to some degree. Could you talk about that reading of Esperanza as both a singular and plural kind of character?
I think most people, the fact that it can be read by virtually anyone from age 10, I think, to 80, 90, and find different things in it. For me, I think what came across really in this most recent reading, after having not read it again for a long time, was in fact the foregrounding of this inner life of Esperanza, the extent to which it's sometimes dubbed as a coming of age novel. That's sort of pressing it into a genre or trappings that I think probably are supplementary. It is about the evolving awareness of this young woman and her voice. So for instance, one piece that just deals with the shape of clouds.
Yeah.
And the kind of kaleidoscopic improvisation on the shape of clouds. What really struck me on this most recent reading was the deep interiority of it, even as it captures moments of dialogue. A reader will see that you're sort of always in Esperanza's head. You're always within her inner life that seems to have the capacity to be sensitive, if not knowing, of the inner lives of others. And so a great deal of empathy and solidarity and sadness and aspiration, a little bit like another version of it from a very different kind of literary cultural frequency would be Henry James. Mm-hmm. Henry James's characters have this quality of always anticipating what someone else is thinking and then responding to that thought before the thinker can be expressing it, and yet they've gone through several. There's that quality of interiority to the voice that Sandra developed for Esperanza. And I think it's evident for readers who want to kind of go on beyond Mango Street, it becomes much more evident still in her epic novel, Caramelo, which is a multi-generational novel that spans Chicago to Mexico City to Acapulco and has a lot of ancestral presences in it, a lot of ghostly presences. Mm. So some of it becomes literal interaction with spirits. I think all of that's germinal in Mango and comes to fruition in many ways in Caramelo, but is also present in numerous stories. Yeah. Wow.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia Senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by Katie Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant rivals to lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Louise can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by Katie Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
it's hard to go back in time and guess. I guess two related questions. One is how to capture the surprise, if not the surprise, or the wonderment at the millions and millions of copies sold of Mongo Street all over the world. And then also it being a formative text in this, especially in this moment of Chicanx literature being, if not mainstream, opening up, changing and evolving. How do you relate those two things, or how do you reconcile those two things happening, if at all?
Well, it's been a long journey, and in some respects, yeah, there has been a great burgeoning, but on the other hand, Chicanx letter is still very marginal to the American literary culture. Some friends and I keep a kind of an informal tally of how often the New York Times Book Review, for instance, will deign to review a Chicanx literary book. They can be numbered on one hand with a few fingers left on an annual basis. So there's still this kind of befuddlement about where Chicanx letters live in the American literary milieu, in the American literary canon. And I think it's important in this case that this edition is in the Everyman series.
Yes.
This noble, august series. I remember it, at least in its inception, was much more proletarian in its packaging and affordability. But they're beautiful editions now and not terribly expensive. So they're still meant to be putting the great wealth of world letters into as many people's hands as possible. This is the first book written by a Chicanx author in that series. This is the very first such book. And I think one of the reasons that has happened undoubtedly is just what we find in Mongo Street, what you talk about, especially in terms of the scope of international impact the book has had in translation. The fact that there's something in Esperanza Sandra's vernacular here, the literary vernacular that's been created for this book, that has this broad human quality to it. And it may be that Chicanx letters has been fraught with great attention to detail of specifically Chicano worlds, or trying to make up for exclusion by overemphasizing the everyday quality of Chicano life, Chicanx household life. I think the magic of Mongo Street is that the presence of this voice has a recognizability to it that maybe underlies ethnic detail. It underlies what a lot of Mexican-American authors have really sought to kind of amp up, that sense of this is what our world is like. And in the case of Esperanza, she's a human witness in a Chicana body to the world around her. And specifically, it was another thing that was a remarkable kind of anomaly, departure in terms of Chicanx letters, which was that it was urban in its setting.
Right.
So a lot of our classic literature has had either rural or semi-rural settings. Think about something like Tomás Rivera's Y No Se Le Tragó La Tierra, and the Earth Did Not Swallow Him, set in rural South Texas. Another classic of Chicanx letters, but perhaps more challenging for people who don't find a way to connect to the specificity of South Texas rural reality. The urban setting that Esperanza dwells in has a kind of a cosmopolitan quality to it.
Yeah. And, you know, that borderlands, that Anzal Dua quality is more abstract in Mongo Street. It's not a physical borderlands, but it's a psychological, it's a cultural, it's an age one. So there's a lot of entry points for someone. I mean, most people at one point or another feel betwixt and between at some point. Yeah. And this has a lot of ways for people to connect with feeling betwixt and between.
I mean, that early era of Chicano, Chicana literature that Sandra and I were too young to be participants in. We were, I think, both of us observers. I had some cousins who were involved in the movement here in San Antonio, Texas. A lot of that work has beautiful literary qualities. Often, though, they can be stentorian. They can be more like manifestos, like sometimes fiery, sometimes resolute, very much connected to this movement for coming to light in the United States as a distinct community that had been sort of not invited in necessarily to literary culture.
Yeah.
And so I think especially for writers after Sandra, it became part of what Sandra's achievement with Mongo Street, I think, helped to facilitate in our community was this sense of going inward outside of any specific given context of the social and the historical setting of our predicament as people living in the occupied mm-hmm. territories of the American Southwest. All of that began to just be one part of
right.
a much broader palette of possibilities. So I think a lot of folks got the spark of recognition that led a lot of writers that led them to create new kinds of work. And it's remarkable to see when you go to a reading for Sandra, when she's maybe about 2 years ago, there was the launch of her collection at Texas State University at the Wittliff Archive. And there were maybe 700 people turned out. And it was just an incredible scene, the passion of the readers of all ages. And then Sandra interacting with each one of them to sign their books for hours, literally hours. There are not a lot of writers who will put it out there that way these days.
Yeah.
And yeah. It tests any writer's mettle, but Sandra does it kind of unstintingly.
Well, and I think, again, my own reading experience is not representative by any stretch of the imagination, but it might be indicative in some degree, which was Mongo Street has a lot of entry points for a lot of different kinds of people.
Yeah.
It is subversive in a very subverting kind of way, right? Because
yeah.
it kind of can come under the cover of night and being very, feeling like it might be small, feeling like it might be understated, feeling
yeah.
like it might be, if not obtuse, then ambiguous, so that it can be taught, for example, to me
yeah.
in a Kansas high school that is pretty conservative, all things
yeah.
considered, but a high school English teacher of a certain bent
yeah.
and bring it in, and you can teach one piece of it. You could teach one of the vignettes. You could read it like
yeah.
a poem and do one class about it without
right.
having the library to buy it or buy a bunch
yeah.
of so I think I'm interested in like the sort of physical realities of how these things become their own entities. And I do think there's something there about the form, function, and structure which made it able to slip through cracks, right? And there's cost
yeah.
to that. Some of the specificity,
yeah.
as you talk about, some of the overt political and cultural discussion and representation and documentation, frankly, of ways of life.
Yeah.
And that's a trade-off. And I think
right.
maybe that's what you're kind of saying is like, this was a trade-off people working in Chinook didn't either consider or understand how it could work or even what the trade-off might actually look like to some degree.
Yeah, I think it's important also just to recognize that Sandra is a great reader. So
yeah.
they're great. There's a confluence of literary influences in the work that also were uncharacteristic of Chicano writers of that time. The first generation wasn't necessarily interested in much schooling about Western literature, British or Central European literature and translation, the novel as a tradition. There was an urgency to the work that really dictated kind of focusing on things at hand, injustice, exclusion, violence. So there's that aspect of Sandra's work that kind of was this broadening the scope. And Sandra had also somewhat unusually had traveled abroad and made her way around Europe and had some experiences in Paris and in the Mediterranean. And before we met, she'd just come back from a lengthy stay. At that time, it was in the Mediterranean where she was finishing Mongo Street. So all of those things were new directions. And we're still kind of feeling our way into how to dwell as voices of the Chicanx world in a global setting.
Yeah.
So this kind of does that for us in a way that's very powerful symbolically to be part of the Everyman series, which had already included García Márquez and Isabel Allende, a couple of titles from each of them, I think, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
First one means perhaps, well, there will be others to come.
It has to be a first for there to be a second and a third and a fourth and a fifth.
Exacto.
I think if you don't end your introduction this way, it comes towards the end. I think maybe this is a good place to wrap up with you is that you wrote about your daughter's first experience reading Mongo Street in the introduction. Could you say a little bit about that and what that was, how that was and wasn't illuminating, and what you were seeing from it as through a fresh pair of eyes that are related to
yours. Well, our daughter, my wife, Frances Santos, she's a poet. And so we both kind of grew up in literary culture. And Francesca is 13 years old. And so she's known Sandra since she was born, Tia Sandra. So, but had never read Mango Street before. So when Sandra asked me to write the introduction, I thought one of the things that would be really cool would be to have Francesca de la Cruz Santos respond to it. And what's in that introduction is the entirety, it's unedited, of her response. And I think, I mean, what she says about it in so many ways is just kind of direct in terms of the truth she heard in Esperanza's voice. But it ends with her saying that it gave her this sense of pride in being Mexican-American, being Chicana. So that itself is just such is the nucleus, maybe, of a certain number of readers, because some of those readers aren't all Mexican-Americans. Right. But within our community, it remains very active in the way that it can offer this embrace and a sense of being at the center of some kind of a literary energy rather than at the margins. It's worth noting that not only did it take a while for Every Man a literature series to kind of come around to a Latinx author, Mango Street was never reviewed in the New York Times, the Washington Post. They're doing those makeup obituaries every now and then.
Right,
now.
Yes.
They might consider doing a makeup review. But I think it's indicative of this kind of larger question. So Francesca just went straight to that part of the book's impact. I think it's often the case for a lot of Chicanx writers. We're writing for the world, but we're writing for the pueblo as well. Toni Morrison put that in always really profound ways, because with Toni's work, she was impugned early in her literary career for not broadening out. She was writing too much into the kind of the Black world. And she famously observed, like, invisible man, invisible to who? She was writing for people that she wanted to come into contact with, her own community. And then the broader world came later. And that's the trajectory that Mango Street has traced.
Huge thanks to Professor Santos for talking with me about this historic book. You might be interested in checking out his own memoir, Places Left Unfinished at the Time of Creation. That's a hell of a title, by the way. And again, the Everyman's Library edition of The House on Mango Street is out now. Thanks so much for listening. Be on the lookout for new episodes of First Edition in the coming weeks. I've had some great conversations with terrific writers and more in the offing. And until next time, read something great.